My name is Ann Gardner, and to my right is Sue Walker, and to my left is Bob McCoy, and we three are your panel for this afternoon. We have two cases scheduled for oral argument, and we'll just start right now if y'all are ready.
Ready, Your Honor.
Ready, Your Honor.
Okay. Good. Megan, would you call the first case? Excuse me, please.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Brown to argue for appellant and Mr. Arthur Anderson to argue for appellee.
Mr. Brown?
May it please the court, Mr. Anderson. My name is Robert Brown, and I have the privilege today of representing the town of Flower Mound, its town manager, Harlan Jefferson, and its finance director, Chuck Springer, who were sued by plaintiff Rembert Enterprises over a road construction dispute. I believe there was a plea of the jurisdiction, and we're here today on appealing the partial denial of that plea of the jurisdiction. The facts, I think, are pretty much set forth in the briefs, but to hit some salient points for point of reference, basically, back in March of 2007, Rembert Enterprises owned 23 acres in Flower Mound. It was pretty much landlocked. There was a road above it and a road below it, but it had a mobile home park on it, and the road access was kind of like gravel driveways. Rembert came to the town and asked for a change of zoning from the manufactured home park to a traditional 52-lot residential subdivision. And the town's ordinances required, like most towns, that if you're going to build a subdivision, you have to have 2 points of ingress and egress for fire, safety, EMS. It's just basic planning that if you're going to have a subdivision that has a lot of people in it, you have to have 2 good access points, this one to the north and this one to the south. Now, the town had concerns, and these are expressed in the minutes and the various matters that are in the record, and all of this, these are facts as established by their pleadings, and as established by the plea to jurisdiction evidence that took place at the evidentiary hearing on this matter. But the town was concerned about approving this development plan because this road that needed to be built would have to go north and south on property that Rembert did not own. And there was great concern about how can we approve a development plan that would start the process to allow 52 homes to be built when there's no guarantee that this road can be built because he didn't own the land, north and south, that needs this road to be built. I believe it's tab 4 to the brief of our main brief. It shows you the development plat. You can see this road, half of it basically is within the subdivision, half of it is north, and half of it is south. This particular road, Auburn Drive, was also on the town's impact fee schedule, which means it's a road that the town could build sometime in the future as part of its impact fee plan. But it wasn't on the town's impact fee CIP. In other words, it wasn't planned to be built anytime in the foreseeable future. There was at least a 10-year window, so this road wasn't going to be built by the town, at least within the foreseeable future, within the next 10 years. Now, Rembert didn't want to wait 10 years to build his subdivision, and the town also had concerns about letting him go now without these road right-of-way agreements. So they approved the development plan, but also in conjunction with that, there was a development agreement that memorialized these conditions that said, you understand, We could just say no, but we're not going to say no. We're going to say yes, but you promise that you're going to obtain this road right-of-way north and south. And they enter into an agreement with the with Mr. Rembert that discusses that. Now, as importantly, as part of that agreement, there was some language in there where Mr. Rembert and Rembert Enterprises agreed to waive any challenges to this construction requirement, either under the takings laws or under impact fee laws. It was an agreement on timing and accommodation. Now, back in August of 2008,
Mr. Brown, ma'am.
How much of this is really relevant to the plea to the jurisdiction?
Well, I believe it's all relevant to the plea to the jurisdiction because you have to figure out what have they sued us for. Well, they've sued us for a breach of one of these agreements, the second agreement. They've also said that this agreement requires you to pay us $600,000 in impact fees. They've also sued us for breach for declaratory judgment saying you should declare this agreement says we owe them $600,000 in impact fees. They've also sued for attorney's fees related to that, and then they've also alleged a taking claiming that, well, if you didn't pay us, then you took us, and therefore the taking says we have to pay you $600,000 in impact fees. But it's all relevant. I know they have argued that we're trying to argue this case on the merits. And while the law is correct that you don't have immunity from a takings cause of action. But the law says you don't just get to plead, there's a takings cause of action. Plea of the jurisdiction, the protection the legislature has given governmental immunities, says that the plaintiff has to plead and plead specific facts to show that if accepted as true, that there would be a taking of property. So I believe all of this information is relevant to show the factual context of the agreement under which they've sued us. I'm not sure if I answered your question correctly or to your satisfaction.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have this second agreement, and this is the one that they've sued us over. And the second agreement basically says, you know, we let them have the development plan as an accommodation, even though they didn't have the road right-of-ways. And then it turned out that the town's engineering standards said, well, you also need to have a dedicated right turn lane from this road to the north onto the property so that people don't get rear-ended while they've got their blinker on turning into your subdivision. And because TxDOT was working on 1171 at that time, there was some questions as to the timing. So the town said, you work that out with TxDOT, and you get that right turn lane done, and we'll issue the next series of permits to allow you to develop. Or if you can't get that done with TxDOT, then you can escrow some money, and we'll get it done later. And once again, this was an accommodation. This agreement also says, and don't forget, you still have to build Auburn Drive. That's what the development plan said. That was the requirement of the development plan. So once again, it simply memorialized and incorporated by reference these conditions that were attached to the development permit. This agreement also said you waive impact fee claims, you waive taking claims, you're represented by a lawyer. And importantly, there are a series of emails that are in the record that predate this agreement where the town has made it abundantly clear that you will only get reimbursed up to 50% of your costs of building this road.
But that's not in the agreement, is that right?
Well, it's not in the agreement. And the agreement simply states the language. It tracks the language from the town's impact fee ordinance. And it uses the verbiage about developer eligible contributions. And apparently there was a question, what is that? What do you mean by developer eligible contribution? And Mr. Rimbert wanted to know, what does that mean? How much am I going to get back? And there's a series of emails in there where the town staff talked to Mr. Rimbert and saying, you'll get 50% back. Once again, if you look at this road, 50% of the road is within his subdivision, and basically 50% is outside of his subdivision. The way the impact fee system works is really simple. Basically, under state law, or at least under the way town staff has interpreted state law, we can only collect 50% of the impact fees that are needed to build something. So it works one of two ways. Either the town builds the road and pays for it and collects 50% of the money from the developer, or the developer builds the road and the town pays him 50% of the money. But in either event, at the end of the day, town pays for 50% of the road, developers pay for 50% of the road. 50% of this road is directly right within the subdivision of Mr. Rimbert, and the other 50% is basically outside of it.
I'm having a problem because I'm
yes, ma'am.
A math person. The 50%, though, it's because 50% is inside the property and 50% is out, or is it coming from formula?
Well, it's coming from the formula. In this case, it just happens to be that half of this road is within the city and half of it is, within the property, half is without the property. Okay. But the formula actually comes by the town's view of state law that says we can only collect 50%. We certainly can't pay out more than we collect. In other words, then the taxpayers would be paying for a road instead of the newcomers and the impact. So really that brings us then to a number of issues on appeal. I'm just going to try to hit the ones I think that are most important given the time constraints. And one of them is Rimbert's deck action. And Rimbert has basically said, we want a declaratory judgment action that you owe us this money. And they say, you don't have immunity from declaratory judgment. But as the Texas Supreme Court said in the federal sign case, which is cited in our brief, and as this court recently recognized in the City of Crowley case cited in our brief, where a declaratory judgment is really a recasting of a claim for a breach of contract, or the essence of the declaratory judgment is at the end of the day, we want you to make declarations that say that somebody owes you money or that sets forth the groundwork for that the next logical step is someone owes you money, then sovereign immunity is implicated and declaratory judgment should not be granted in that kind of a case. A plea of the jurisdiction should be granted on that kind of deck action because immunity from suit is not waived when the purpose of your deck action is not to declare your rights, but to set the groundwork for the payment of money.
What is the deck action based on the August 4th agreement, or is it based on an ordinance, or is it based on state law?
It's a little unclear from the pleading. Their pleading seemed to say one thing, and their brief seemed to say another thing. Clearly, it's at least in part based on the agreement. They want you to declare this agreement and say, under this agreement, they owe us more money than what they paid us. The town paid them basically $798,000, you know, more than half the road, but they say we're entitled to the other $606,000. They also seem to be saying that the state impact fee laws say you have to owe us this money. Now, their briefs say we're not asking for a refund or a credit or payment under the state's impact fee laws, but they've kind of worked that into their pleading. But to the extent that they are making an impact fee claim, then I respectfully submit that that's not valid because you have this agreement which expressly waives impact fee claims as well as takings claims. I think the real issue in this case that's novel is the breach of contract case. And as this court has recently issued opinions, and this is an area of law that's in flux as to the intent of the legislature's crafting of Chapter 271, which provides for a limited waiver of immunity to sue a city for a breach of contract if it's a contract for providing goods and services to the city. Now, this is a first impression issue, I respectfully submit, because the question is, does an agreement which doesn't really come up with the operative term, but simply takes those terms and it's a memorialization of terms that were already attached to permits and development conditions and simply memorializes those and puts them in an agreement as an accommodation, a timing as to when you have to meet these obligations. In other words, the agreement says you have already previously agreed under ordinances and conditions of approval to do A, B, C, and D. This agreement now states when you have to do A, B, C, and D and sets forth the parameters. The cases that Rembert has provided you, they're not the same kind of case. There are cases like the Ben Bolt case where there was a question of whether a school district could sue the risk pool for insurance coverage over water and mold damage. There's the Kirby Lake, the MCR, and the Wright case, the RIGHT case, are all cited in the brief. Those are also traditional lease purchase type contracts where a city contracts with the developer and says, you build this, you sell it to us, you build it, you lease it to us. We're expressly directing and dictating you got to go out and hire contractors, you have to hire engineers that meet our requirements. Those are all cases where the government, quite frankly, was buying something. And when they didn't honor their obligations, they got sued and they had to answer for that suit. The most recent case that Rembert's put for you is Houston versus Williams, came out March 18th from the Texas Supreme Court. That was a civil service case where they were looking at firefighter claims, whether city ordinances that set forth pay scales and said that you shall be paid at this pay grade and if you leave you get this payment, is that a contract? And he said it was. But once again, those are benefits going directly to the governmental entity.
I was building a road, not services to the city.
Because the agreement doesn't require that a road be built. The road requirement comes from the development agreement. Now, is there some indirect benefit to the city? Sure, it's a road, but the question is the timing. For the road to be built today directly benefits Mr. Rembert. For the town, 5-10 years from now, perhaps, when it goes on its schedule and acquisition schedule, but it's not really providing goods or services to the town, that the town gets an incidental benefit. And the question is, they're suing us on the agreement. The agreement doesn't require a road be built. If they want to sue us under the ordinances and development approval and the permits and say that somehow that development plan, which says I have to build a road, creates a contract, then that's another cause of action. It's another theory. They haven't alleged that. They've alleged the agreement is for breach of contract, but the agreement doesn't require the building of the road. The agreement talks about when you build the road, as previously agreed, and how you, under the town's impact fee ordinances, could ask for a refund, ask for a credit, and it all relates simply to the timing of it. And I think this there's a sound public policy involved here, too. I mean, in this case, the town could have clearly just said, we're going to deny all these various things you've asked for. We're going to deny your development plan because you don't have the right-of-way. We're going to deny your record plat because you don't have the right turn lane. But they didn't do that. They said, we'll allow you to do that and condition it on these conditions, and then they memorialize the conditions in a separate piece of writing. You know, if cities are going to be liable and waive their immunity for a breach of suit simply by entering into a set of written conditions that attach to a permit, then most municipal clients are going to think hard and twice about doing that. They may just say, look, we'll just deny it, because if I deny it, I'm scot-free. Or we'll just require all these conditions to be somehow stated within the development plat. You'll have a big plat and a permit, and you'll have pages and pages and pages of conditions attached to it, which won't be signed by anybody, but there'll be express conditions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Art Anderson. I represent Reggie Rembert, who's here today, as well as his company, Rembert Enterprises. I want to make very clear at the outset, and I have to correct Mr. Brown, the development agreement in paragraph 5 says the developer is required to construct Auburn Drive, a 60-foot wide right-of-way designated as an urban collector in the thoroughfare plan between FM 1171 and Peters Colony Road. And Justice Gardner, we obviously disagree on timing, but the end result is it is a huge benefit for the town, because this was shown not only on their CIP plan as basically one of those items that the town wanted to have constructed within 10 years, whether it's them or by us, it's also on the master thoroughfare plan, which is basically the public arterials where people go back and forth between major streets. It was not an internal street for this subdivision. So,
which agreement
says this? This is development agreement number 2.
The August agreement?
It is August 4th, I guess, okay. 2008. It's paragraph 7 to the city's brief. And Justice Walker, I think I tend to agree where I think your initial question was is. The factual background, what does it have to do with why we're here today, which is a plea to the jurisdiction based on immunity? And the Supreme Court has interpreted extremely broadly the statutory waiver in 271.152. We have the Ben Bolt case, we have Kirby Lake, we have the Williams case, all of which have come out in the last 2.5 to 3 years, which is several cases for the Supreme Court to be focused on this issue, and they have broadened it more and more and more in terms of saying, once the legislature's made the policy decision that in a contract situation that immunity should be waived, we're going to interpret it pretty broadly. If the legislature doesn't speak, we're probably not, but since they have, we're going to interpret it broadly. And in the Williams case, the court says there's three elements as to whether or not the contract falls within 271.152. One is the party against whom the waiver is asserted must be a local governmental entity, and that town of Flower Mound meets that criteria. Number two, the entity must be authorized by statute or the Constitution to enter into contracts, which it is because it's a home rule municipality. It has the right to do that. Three, the entity must, in fact, have entered into a contract that is subject to this subchapter. And then it breaks down and says, a contract subject to this subchapter is defined as a written contract stating the essential terms of the agreement for providing goods or services to the local governmental entity that is properly executed on behalf of the local governmental entity. And that's it. Those are the three elements. There's not, does it also reflect some development approvals? Could it have been, is it possible we might not have entered into the agreement? None of those items are relevant to the Supreme Court's analysis as to what type of contracts fall within this waiver of immunity. So clearly we have a contract that is subject to, and even in the brief that Mr. Brown prepared on page 42, he says, while Rembert obviously used both goods and services to construct Auburn Drive before it became the property of the town. And if you look at the reimbursements that are part of the record, They reimbursed for goods and services, which were the contractor's fees, engineering, surveying, the paving materials, and all those kinds of things. So I think it's really clear that this is a contract that the legislature and the Supreme Court has said is subject to the immunity provision. Where it ties into, and this was a good question, I've struggled with it, is how does that tie into the ordinance in the statute, in the impact fee statute? When I pled this case, I obviously, out of abundance of caution, I did a breach of contract claim, declaratory judgment, because the town's impact fee ordinance provides for full reimbursement if a developer pays for a street that's on the capital improvements plan. It specifically says that the developer gets full reimbursement. The contract cites to that section of the ordinance. So we basically have a provision where it's clear that this was a street that was built on the public thoroughfare plan. It's in on the capital improvement plan, which is under the impact fee statute. You look at a 10-year time frame for these improvements, and that's how your impact fee is calculated. When it came time to do the prove up, basically there's this long page and you have it in there, and they deduct all of these expenses, which rightfully they should do, and I don't think there's any dispute on that. Again, that's for the merits in terms of assuming the trial court can consider those. But they said the amount that you're entitled to reimbursement based on is one half the cost of the road and not 100%. And their argument is, and these, I don't think it matters for the purposes of us being here, except for the fact those emails he's talking about are after the first development agreement and after the approvals were done. And they're not reflected in the agreement at all. This is basically the position they're taking so that they don't have to pay 100%. And obviously we disagree, and that's an issue on the merits, probably by summary judgment, as to which interpretation is correct. And what they're saying in their interpretation, this is where the statute comes into play. If you look at the emails that are sent forth, basically they're saying we only have to pay you 50% under section 395.014A7 of the impact fee statute. Impact fee statute is huge, okay, and it has a lot of provisions. But the way that it works is, and if you look at 395.014, it says the political subdivision shall use qualified professionals to prepare the capital improvements plan and to calculate the impact fee. Okay, so this plan is you take all of the streets that the town once built within 10 years and you figure out a cost. Then you figure out how much development there's going to be, and you put a unit fee on each unit of development, so hopefully at the end of the day it will equal to what that cost is. So 395.014 says you need to have this plan to calculate the fee. That's the whole purpose. It's the fee that the home builder will pay at the time of permit, or a shopping center developer will pay at the time of permit. That's the impact fee. And if you go down to 7, it says a plan for awarding, and I won't go into all of it, but basically a credit for the portion of the ad valorem tax and utility service revenues that the developers would pay, or in the alternative, if the town doesn't want to do the math, they can just do a 50% reduction in the maximum assessable fee that they're going to charge. When the town passed their roadway impact fee, they did this, okay? They, like you're supposed to, Kimley Horns, the engineering firm, they prepared their capital improvement plan, and it includes this plan for, and it has different alternatives, for either kind of giving a credit for what the development would contribute to the general economy of the town or to the city, which is ad valorem taxes, utility revenues. Concept is, I think, that new growth should pay for the infrastructure that's triggered by the new growth, but there's also other types of revenue that development brings in, and that there should be a credit for that. So there's two choices the town has. They can go through that exercise, or they can just kind of default to this 50% reduction. And in their capital improvement plan and how they decided on the amount of the impact fee included this. Okay. They've already gone through all that. They're using this in a totally different context, which involves reimbursement to the developer for building a road. And they're basically saying this provision, which doesn't apply, by the way, should be applied to the as to how much a developer who builds a road on the CIP and therefore should be reimbursed is not reimbursed. And that's the dispute and the interplay between the different documents. After reading the Williams case, and so when I pled it originally, I obviously wanted to keep all of my causes of action in the pleadings and to present those to the court. The inverse condemnation cause of action is really an alternative cause of action in case we lost, on the breach of contract and deck action, which is if we were not able to prevail because of a jurisdictional issue on those two, then the inverse condemnation is the alternative. It is basically the amount of trips that would be generated by this subdivision as part of the total capacity of the road. And there's evidence both ways, but it's probably about 5%. And if you go back to Stafford Estates, which is another Flower Mound case, they went up to the Supreme Court. In that case, there was an 18% generation of trips on that road, and the Supreme Court made the town of Flower Mound cut a check for 82% of the cost back to the developer. So the inverse case, I acknowledge, cannot be disguised into a breach or a deck action that in order to avoid the immunity, because inverse condemnation claims immunity is waived because it's a constitutional violation, and I recognize that. I was pleading that in the alternative. I think the only thing that's unique about this case, I think, is the interplay between the three, and I think the Williams Court, I think the Supreme Court addresses that. And in that case, it was basically kind of two things. One was there's, agreements. I don't know much about employment law, but I guess there are some collective service agreements between the firefighters union and the city of Houston. But there's also are these ordinances the city of Houston passed. And the court said, and to me, again, this is broadening the scope of how the Supreme Court views the waiver of immunity in 271, but basically said it goes beyond just a bilateral contract like we have here where both sides signed. I don't think there's a dispute. The council approved this, and it was signed by the appropriate town entity, just like my client was the appropriate representative. This was a series of ordinances that the Supreme Court said actually constituted a contract that was enforceable, and that there was a waiver of immunity as part of that. We kind of have this here, and I'm struggling a little bit because I'm trying to put all the pieces together, because we do have the ordinance and the contract, which our position is requires the town to reimburse us 100%. The town recognizes they were supposed to reimburse us some amount because they did. They reimbursed us one half. And they use as their rationale, which we think is invalid, but is their rationale of going back to this impact fee provision of 395.014, which really doesn't apply in this situation. It goes back to the calculation of the fee. And again, that's an issue on the merits as to the interpretation of the contract. So I think that there is an interplay here between the ordinance, because the contract provides that the developer gets reimbursed in accordance with the impact fee ordinance. So to me, there's kind of two different ways to approach it. One is that the ordinance is actually part of the contract, because that's what the contract says. The contract says, remember, you're going to build a road, and you're going to be your impact fee issues will get resolved and addressed by 4278 of the town's ordinances, which does require a declaration by the trial court or the court of appeals at some point as to what that means. In terms of our position is that we're entitled to 100% reimbursement. Their position is we're only entitled to 50%. But that's the reason why we have the breach of contract, which reading through the Supreme Court cases and also having argued that North Richland Hills case before the court several months ago, I think this is even clearer a case where the contract falls than the North Richland Hills case, which involved numerous types of improvements, and there was issues about what was due and owing and those sorts of things. This one's pretty crystal clear. It's the town said you will build this road and you'll be reimbursed in accordance with our ordinances. The amount that's due and owing is actually pretty clear. It's either going to be zero if they're correct on their interpretation, or it's going to be the other half of the road if we prevail eventually on what we believe is the correct interpretation. So that's, you know, I know it took a long time, and I know this is something of a different case, and I'll agree with Mr. Brown on that issue. I really just don't think it's that novel in terms of the fundamental issue, which is, does this contract meet the elements that the Supreme Court's been pretty clear and has broadened extensively in terms of having a liberal interpretation of the statute? Does this contract fit within those? Absolutely. And I think if you read the contract, it clearly requires an interpretation of their ordinances as a result of that, because that's what the contract provides for. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
That's correct.
Why?
Because that's the way our ordinances require. No, because they...
What did they provide that compelled you in your mind to provide half of the money to the roadway?
Because the road was on our impact fee schedule, which says that we could, the town, at some point in time, we might build this. And if we do build it, we'll collect money from developers to pay for it. All right? But... Who pays for it?
No. In order, you're paying them impact fee because they provided the road, which is a good or a service.
Well, but that's not a good or service being provided by this agreement. That's something that comes from the impact fee. I mean, if they want to argue that the impact, that if I pay money into an impact fee fund and I get a road from it, then there's a contract under the state impact fee statute. That's another case. It's not argued here, and I would say the Williams case rejected that, where the city of Houston versus Williams case, where the firefighters also argued that state statutes were a contract because there was no mutuality there, which is a state statute. But I think it's important to understand, and this is, I know you probably can't see this, but this is tab 4 in the city's main brief, and it's in the record. I mean, it's important, I think, for you to see what's actually out here. And this is a subdivision. And you can see this road that goes right down the middle of the subdivision is the same size as all the other little roads that go through the subdivision. This is not an oversized road. This is not a requirement where the town said you have to build a 4-lane or a 6-lane road. This is a 2-lane road, 1 lane going north, 1 lane going south. Half of it's on the property, half of it's not on the property. Under their theory, they get paid 100% reimbursement. Their theory is the free road theory. Even though this road gets built now, under your timetable, not our timetable, you want to get paid 100% for this road for free. Under our theory, they pay for half the road, we pay for half the road. Under their theory, they get reimbursed 100%, so they get the road now, we don't build it when we would normally fund it, and the town, in essence, has to pay for this entire road, not on our schedule, but on their schedule. That was the whole purpose of those accommodation agreements. I want to just briefly...
concern ourselves, you get the benefit of some 40-odd homeowners now paying fuel taxes, et cetera, by building the road now?
Well, if that was the case, Judge, then every condition that a developer agrees to would be a benefit, and everything would be a contract. I mean, when we tell people you have to build homes that are this big and they have to be built of brick, sure, that brick benefits the community. You got to build sidewalks. That benefits community. I think what the legislature intended is in a contract where the government says, I'm buying this from you. You're building it for me. You're not building it for you. You're building it for me. Then I got to pay for it. But if you're building it for you and I have an incidental benefit, then I'll pay you my share, and I paid you for half of it. And I want to talk about the takings claim real quickly because I didn't address that in the opening. You can't have a taking of property with consent. There's no such thing. It's the plaintiff's burden to prove the jurisdiction to either plead or prove, put facts that show this wasn't consented to. Well, it was consented to. It was consented to in the development conditions, and it was consented to in the agreement. And as this court was aware, and it's Flyer Mound versus Stafford case, which went to the Texas Supreme Court, and subsequent cases from this court, the City of Corinth case, the City of Keller case, both cited in the brief. This court has held that a developer, if they don't want to waive the conditions of permit approval, they have to object. They have to object at every administrative stage. That's what the people did in the Stafford case. That's how Flyer Mound couldn't get off the hook, because the developer agreed to the, said, we're not agreeing to this condition. We'll do it, but we objected. In this case, Rembert didn't object to any of these conditions at the development stage, at the permitting stage, and in the agreements he didn't disagree with it, even though there were emails telling everybody exactly what this agreement meant, at least what the town thought it was meant, and he agreed to it. He was represented by a lawyer, and he agreed to waive all take and impact fee claims. I mean, I don't see how consent could be any clearer. Additionally, if the cause of action is based on the fact that we didn't pay them under the contract, the law is clear. You can't have a taking based on a breach of contract. Mr. Anderson says, well, it's not on a breach of contract. It's really on the development conditions. Well, that's not what the pleadings say, I don't believe. And also, if that's the case, there was an obligation for Rembert to object at every administrative level, like this court found in Stafford and the Corinth case and in the Keller case. Just in closing,
why,
yes, ma'am.
Can he plead it alternatively? It seems to me that you're taking the position that it's inconsistent with his breach of contract claim, but why can't he plead it alternatively?
Well, he can plead it alternatively, but you still have to satisfy the basics of that pleading, and if it's pled alternatively, it still has to be a cause of action that wasn't waived by conduct, by not objecting, and wasn't waived by entering into a contract that expressly said, I waive this in exchange for these concession and timing agreements.
But if the dispute is, I'm not following how you can say that he consented when he's saying that that is not what his understanding of the agreement was.
Well, he's saying that.
You're saying that he consented because of the agreement, and he's saying that's not what the agreement says.
Well,
right?
That's what he's saying, Your Honor, but you look at the extrinsic evidence that's in the record that shows the events leading up to the agreement, the discussions in the Planning and Zoning Commission in the minutes where they say,
that,
you understand you have to build
judgment?
This?
Isn't that a summary judgment? I mean, in a plea to the jurisdiction, don't we look at it as if the developer is the summary judgment non-movement, so if he's raised a fact issue on it, then
and that's a good point, and you're correct. If a fact issue had been raised, there's no evidence. They still have a burden in a plea to jurisdiction hearing to put on some quantum of evidence to say that I didn't consent to this. All there is a pleading that says I didn't consent to this. Plea the jurisdiction rules say that you have to plead facts, not conclusions. You can't get over immunity just by saying, I plead negligence, I plead your intent, or I plead, that he was coerced and I didn't consent to this. How? You look at all the other evidence in there where there are all these statements and agreements at public hearings and emails that all set forth, to my mind, unequivocally, everybody knew what we were talking about. There's no objection raised at any point of this deal till a lawsuit's filed, and then there's a single sentence in the petition that says, oh, I didn't agree to this. That's not enough. There still has to be more. The burden on the plaintiff, even in a summary judgment context, would be to present enough evidence to create a material fact. I respectfully submit, if you look at the record, there's no material fact here on consent. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Very well-briefed case.
Thank
well
you.
Done. Thanks. And your case is submitted, and you're excused.